Welcome to Bergen Banter, the official Bergen Community College podcast, where we have intelligent, fact-based conversation without the noise and the chatter. I'm Dr. Larry Levanka, your host of the official Bergen Community College podcast. Today, we have Captain Bill Clappert with us, and he is a captain of airplanes. He is a pilot. He has flown Gulfstreams all over the world. He has flown celebrities all over the world. And why are we talking to Captain Bill today? Well, the aviation industry has been in the news quite a bit lately, but is it perception or is it reality of there being more incidents, more issues? And he, as a faculty member here at Bergen Community College, will help us set the record straight. So welcome, Professor Clappert.
Thank you.
So the first question is exactly that. We've seen numerous incidents, whether it's Toronto, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. We've seen them on our social media feeds. We've seen them on the news. There seems to be a larger number of aviation incidents in the last few months than we had seen in the last few years. Is it reality or is it just the perception of what's going on?
I think we have to put into perspective. I've followed this industry for the last 40 years of my life, and the number of incidents is oftentimes directly related to the ability to report these incidents. Mm-hmm. So never in time have we had so many individuals with cameras in their pockets having the ability to put things onto the media that are not typically seen in the past. So that's one of the issues we have. The other issue is that flying has never been more popular. Mm-hmm. Okay, we look at what's happened down at Washington National just as a perfect example, and you look at that airport being designed basically to handle about 15 million passengers per year, mm-hmm. where the reality is right now, Washington National handles about 23 million passengers. Mm. So it's a significant increase in the amount of flying that's going on by the flying public. So I think that's what we're seeing, a proportional increase, plus on top of that, the fact that everyone has the ability to get this information out to the general public.
Well, I mean, even so, right, you talk about it's proportionate to the number of flights and so on. The types of incidents that are occurring, would you scale those against the last few years, the last few decades? Are they more serious or is it, again, back to that proportionality and visibility issue?
I think to put it into perspective, we should look at something we do every day. We drive our car. Okay, last year, about 47,000 people perished driving cars. That's a little bit more than 120 people per day. Mm-hmm. Down at Washington National, as tragic as it was, we lost 67 people in that midair collision. There was more of a human element involved with that than a technological involvement.
Okay, and we'll get there. Okay.
Yeah.
So talk about that. The we all saw it. It was a horrific scene, seeing a midair collision of a helicopter and a plane. It rattles people for sure. What happened there? How does something like that happen?
Yeah, having operated out of that airport for the last 30 years, as well-versed as any pilot, any professional pilot, as to the operations that go on around Washington National. We had a helicopter on a mission. They were required to stay below 200 feet. We also had an airplane which was flying into, and most people don't realize this, Washington National is not one of the busiest airports, but that particular runway is the busiest runway in the United States. Hmm. So we had an airplane that was transitioning from an ILS approach, an instrument landing system approach, where the parameters are very qualified and the airplane is going to stay within a certain parameter in terms of altitude and heading deviation. And then it was clear to do a visual approach to an adjoining runway so that they could get more traffic in. So there's the crux of the story. We're trying to work more traffic into a smaller area. We've got now human error involved where we have a helicopter that has a hard ceiling of 200 feet. Mm-hmm. And by all the data that we saw, ADS-B data, that helicopter had climbed up to about 340 feet just immediately before the impact. Then the other factor that came into play was we have a shortage of air traffic controllers. We currently have 14,000 air traffic controllers, but we have the need for 3,000 additional controllers.
Wow.
Very difficult to hire qualified individuals at such a short notice. So this is the position we're in. And on that particular approach, there normally would have been two controllers visually watching that helicopter and that airplane. And because of scheduling constraints, the tower chief decided to send one of those controllers home. You know, you have to realize that the human element is still huge in aviation. We can't just throw technology at things and expect that to solve the problem. So that's the big crux of the issue.
Let's bookmark the human element there, because I do want to get back to the aviation industry and profession. You had said before that this helicopter was supposed to be at 200 and it ended up at 300. Is that an error of both the tower and the pilot, or take us through how something like that happens where they miss a mark by a significant margin?
Yeah, and it does seem like a significant margin to
a layperson,
the general public, exactly. But what you have to realize is a 100-foot altitude change for a helicopter or an airplane is literally the weight of your hand on that control yoke, and momentarily just losing your focus. It only takes seconds to get off 100 feet. I tell my students all the time, when they're 200 or 300 feet off their altitude, you realize you're off your altitude by the height of a 30-story building. Mm. But in an airplane, it's very hard to conceptualize that, how quickly that can happen. So these pilots were required in the Black Hawk helicopter to stay at or below 200 feet. So it's a human error element, unfortunately, that comes into play.
And just bad timing in that scenario where you have an inbound plane coming at the same time that you have that momentary flux in your distance from the ground, right?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, Larry, technology does play a big part in this. We have advanced systems for terminal collision avoidance so that we don't have conflicts with other airplanes. But when we compress these airplanes into 200 or 300 feet between the airplane and the surface of the globe, that becomes a big issue. So what happens for example, in my airplane, when we're below 1,000 feet, the terminal collision avoidance system is actually decreased in its sensitivity because we don't want to pick up other aircraft that are on the ground, for example. So in this case, they didn't get the same type of resolution advisory that they would have gotten had they been at a higher altitude. It was actually impeded to a certain extent.
So when the public see something like that tragedy, or an airplane inverted, as it was in Toronto, and ended up on its back, and people standing on the wing. Last week, I believe there was an incredible shot of people walking out on the wing of the plane because there was fire in the or a smoke in the cockpit or smoke in the cabin. You know, what is the message to the general public that hey, look, airlines are very safe, flying is very safe, or do you say something else to them?
Technology has done amazing things for the crews on the flight deck. I had essentially four screens in the Gulfstream that I could allot to any type of information that I wanted to have at my fingertips. I could have radar. I could have my flight path. I always had the ability to monitor other airplanes around me. So when you look at the technology that we have today in airplanes compared to just 15 or 20 years ago, it is far superior. Mm. So the ability for us to monitor traffic around us is always there. But again, in both of these cases, the accident up at Pearson in Toronto, it's the human element that we have to deal with. The last few seconds of flight in both of these cases, one being an error most likely by the flight crew on the Black Hawk helicopter, from what I've read just recently about the Pearson accident, and I have thousands and thousands of hours in that type of Bombardier aircraft, is that the crew did not respond properly to the variable wind conditions that they had at the time.
So we're going to talk about the we said we were going to put a bookmark in it before about the air traffic controllers, but it sounds like we've now heard two human error as part of the flight crew. Are pilots, flight crews getting trained properly? Is that a problem? Is the system that is preparing pilots to fly aircraft not up to par? Or is it just, again, a bad luck in a situation like either DC or Toronto?
Well, when you look at how technology has been embraced, and I look at our school, for example, we have five brand new simulators that I'm able to reproduce any potential scenario in an airplane for our students. So here we have students beginning their flying careers, being exposed to things that someone like myself would have to be in an actual airplane to be exposed to those typical scenarios, a wind shear scenario, an issue with another airplane in close proximity to our airplane without a lot of, we'll call it wiggle room. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at just the standard separations on airplanes, it was a big deal, Larry, when we went from 2,000-foot separation between airplanes to 1,000-foot separation. Okay, when we did that, that was because of technology, the ability to rely on these digital systems. So again, you can see the technology really didn't fail us in these two incidents. It's the last bit of human input that probably failed us in both cases.
Well, and to your point earlier, is it because we're pushing the envelope a little bit more? We're putting more people in the sky. We're putting more planes in the sky, creating more traffic. Does that inherently lead to more mistakes?
I don't think it's mistakes that happen as much as you start to increase the odds because of the number of situations we're putting pilots into.
Makes sense. Okay. More cars on the road, same thing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, when it plays out that news cycle, we are all exposed to information, whether it's correct or not. And that's the problem that I have when I teach my classes. We immediately break down what happened with this accident, really. Who did the media interview first? Oftentimes, it's the passengers in the back of the airplane who have really no idea what the flight crew has done to keep that flight safe. And if we look at historical records, we are in a period of incredible aviation safety. I never felt safer in an airplane than I did throughout the end of my career.
So let's go back now to the air traffic controller issue, because it is an issue. As you said, I think you said we have 14,000, but we really need 17,000. That's
exactly
pretty significant.
Correct.
So what's the problem? Why don't we have air traffic controllers?
The first problem is the training for that is extremely difficult. Okay, I have friends in air traffic control. I have friends in Newark Tower. They'll be the first ones to tell me that oftentimes they're offered different positions. They can move from Newark Tower to a radar control facility, for example. And the training is so difficult that even seasoned air traffic controllers wash out of that program. So now fast forward to trying to bring people either in from the military, bring people in from experienced aviators, whether they're pilots or they had air traffic control experience in another country or in another service, it becomes extremely difficult to get these qualified individuals not only to apply for the position but also to carry off and get through the training.
Are they compensated well enough? I mean, is it a matter of money that, you know, they can take those skills, go somewhere else and not have the responsibility, right? Make more money. Is that part of it?
That's a really valid question. And I will clearly state that air traffic controllers are the highest paid civil servants in our country.
Okay,
they have a very high level of intelligence. I've been up in the tower hundreds and hundreds of times. I'm amazed at how calmly they handle very stressful situations. So it's not an easy job. And that's, I think, what creates this hiring issue, is that people look at it, is it worth even for that amount of money to have that
Level of responsibility.
And responsibility.
Yeah. So So you talk about the pipeline for an air traffic controller, typically military technology. It takes a high level of intelligence. Is there a way to spur greater numbers of people getting into this industry in order to perform this, as you said, incredibly important task and responsibility?
That's an incredibly valid question, and that's what I think the value is of programs like we have at Bergen right. Community College. I get the word out to students. Being a pilot is a great thing, but also being an air traffic controller can be as equally satisfying in terms of our career satisfaction, and it can be equally satisfying in terms of compensation. But again, it's difficult to motivate people when the first thing you do when you become an air traffic controller is you're probably going to have to pick up and move somewhere. My best friend, who's born and bred in New Jersey, ended up starting his career down in Florida. Eventually, when he got the seniority and the experience, he was able to move up to Newark Tower. So,
is this something that, do you think federal government is aware of the issue? Do you think they're taking action to resolve it? Are there other things that the federal government could be doing? In your perspective, where does government fit into this puzzle?
Yeah, the government has been aware of the issue, and it's ongoing, because even as you hire in qualified personnel, people age out. And one of the things about air traffic controllers is that they have a very limited career, so they have to retire at a certain time. So they can basically put in 20 years, and then they're essentially forced to retire. There's this burnout fear. So maybe we have to readdress that. When I look at aviation, for years, the retirement age was 60. And about 10 years ago, we ramped it up to 65. And it was all due to the fact that the need was there. We needed qualified individuals in the cockpit, and we needed to offset a pilot shortage. Now we're talking about going to 67. So is it unreasonable to think that we could maybe increase the amount of time that air traffic controllers have to put in? That's something that might be addressed by the federal government. With all the cuts and all the things that are happening right now, what sort of negative impact does that have? That's going to be interesting to see.
So, yeah, it's definitely, it seems like an industry that is under attack from a bunch of different sources. And one of them is the flying public, right? You also see on social media, you see on the news, people behaving badly when they're flying. And again, the sort of rats in a cage scenario that we discussed before might be part of it, but man, flying is not the activity of kings that it may have been years ago. It is a rat race in order to get on that flight. The industry knows that. The industry sees that. How does the industry respond to, again, these pressures from the public who wants to fly?
Sure. That, again, is a great question. And I think we have to look at the big picture. In 2020, we had an epidemic, okay? And that pandemic created huge problems for the airlines, okay? Their supply chains started to be affected. And that supply chain issue has carried forward even to today. You've seen the problems with the 737, for example. Boeing is now just getting up to the point where they're able to meet the requirements for orders that they've logged in the last 4 or 5 years. So that becomes one of the issues. The other issue is we have so many passengers flying that, for example, I just got back from a wonderful vacation down at Turks and Caicos, showed up at the airport. The other whole end of the business that we don't look at is the TSA. How does the TSA adjust to this increase in traffic, the amount of people who want to fly? So when we showed up at the airport 2 hours early, there was an hour and 45 minute wait just to go through security.
Wow.
So that creates an issue.
Yep. And stress. If,
and people are on a hair trigger now. Yep. By the time they get onto that airplane, I stood out in basically the parking lot in Turks and Caicos in the blazing sun waiting to go through security. And I'm used to this. This is what I did for a living. But I heard people on the line. People were upset. And it does carry over into the airplane. So there's other situations that we also have to look at when we increase the amount of passengers that are flying.
So then what is the message to the industry then, right? Because it just seems like, at least to a layperson, it's undermanned, understaffed, congested, all of this happening at the same time. It just seems like this perfect storm that there is no escape unless there is major change that is affected somewhere. So what does the industry do to make this a more comfortable, better experience all around?
The industry has had to adapt their hiring process. If you go back 30, 40 years, most of the pilots that were hired by the airlines came out of the military. Now the military doesn't train as many pilots. We have these wonderful devices called drones, which don't require any pilots to be in the cockpit. So you can see where this is going. We've got people retiring on one end. Mm-hmm. We're implementing more aircraft into the fleet on another end. So we've got a shortage on the one end, a shortage on the other end for new pilots. We've got to do something. So one of the programs that we're involved with at the school is both United and American Airlines have American has their cadet program, United has their aviate program. What they do, and we refer to this in the industry as zero to hero, they hire qualified candidates, oftentimes people that I vetted for their programs, to start off with zero experience, only the experience they've gotten with a Gulfstream captain in the simulators at Bergen Community College, get all of their ratings, and then they get hired by the airline. So there's a career path from the time they're 21 years old. So this is what the airlines are doing to make up for this shortage of pilots. And it's a really valid, very exciting program.
Yeah. I mean, that's one encouraging sign, at least to hear about, right? Are there others, and maybe it is related to technology and different things that can be integrated into the industry, what else might be on the horizon that can help alleviate some of these pressures that the airline industry is facing?
Yeah, well, technology is always going to be the fundamental aspect of flying an airplane. So as we see these technological advances come into the flight deck, for example, this reduces pilot workload. So now pilots aren't as stressed. So can we increase, for example, incrementally the number of hours that pilots fly if they're not feeling as much stress in the cockpit? So that's an option, because typically airline pilots are limited to a certain number of hours per month, about 100 hours per month. And it doesn't seem like much, but that's 100 hours of actual flying time in the airplane. Doesn't include your time on the road, doesn't include your pre-flight time and things of that nature. So I think with technology, we'll be able to modify the work schedules of pilots so that potentially we can get more productivity out of each pilot.
Is there a scenario where the industry contracts? And here's what I mean, that they reduce the number of available flights, charge more, and thereby reducing the need for more pilots, more air traffic controllers, for more ground staff, et cetera, et cetera. Do you envision a scenario where that's possible, or do you think it's just this exponential curve where we're just going to keep adding more and more and more and stress onto the industry?
I think it becomes an economic issue,
yeah.
And that's the thing we have to look at, disposable income. And you brought up a very valid point. Flying is relatively cheap.
Yeah.
You remember the days when you showed up at the airport suit and tie on, and it was a major event. Mm-hmm. We all realize now that that's been diminished to, I don't want to say a bus trip, but it's not as prestigious.
Right.
But it's still, you know, the safety aspects are still important. So again, how much can we increase prices to throw technology at the issue. Maybe it's not the technology, because Larry, I'll be honest with you, I think we're on the cutting edge of technology all the time in aviation. What we have to throw at the industry is personnel. Okay, we've got to get the staffing of air traffic control up to a point. You know, and when you read behind, look behind the scenes, and I talk to my air traffic controller buddies, they're the ones that will tell you on the QT, yeah, we're probably working some forced overtime. We're probably having to come in here. And it's that insidious stress when you're in a stressful situation that really starts to build after potentially months or years of living through that. So that's where I think we have to throw the money at. Personnel, human beings. We've had this shortage now ongoing. Government is aware of it. They really have to do something to create, alleviate the problem.
So all of that said, and you did say it earlier as well, the message was you've never felt safer in an aircraft as you do right now. Is that the case? Is that the message to the public that air travel is really safe, even if it is stressful at times for the flying public?
It is extremely safe. And when you look at the training that pilots go through, the advancements in simulator technology, now we have $10,000 simulators at Bergen Community College. I flew in $10 million full motion simulators at Flight Safety International. Okay, this is incredibly advanced training, able to replicate any potential scenario into a level of the accuracy that you would see in an airplane. So I don't feel that there's ever going to be a safety issue in terms of the training of pilots. It's just going to come down to, can this industry keep up with the ever-increasing pressure it's getting from the number of people that are flying on the airplanes?
All right. So no reservations about getting on a plane this summer and taking a trip for vacation?
Absolutely not. I don't check to make sure it's an Airbus as compared to a Boeing product. Boeing has been vetted by the FAA over the last few years, and I think the end result will be they'll be back to the level of putting out a superior product that they have for the last 60 or 70 years.
Mm. Great conversation on the aviation industry, and who better to do it than our professor, Bill Clappert, who is, well, also a captain of many aircraft during his day. So never mind the noise and the chatter. This was the intelligent, fact-based conversation that you only find at Bergen Banter. We will see you once again down the road.